listeners, to time for an awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, new media for the new millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." But we as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, "Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom. And with all thy getting, get an understanding." Again, welcome to the program this evening with your host, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com. That's timeforanawakening.com and listen to the program streaming live from the website. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening and listen to the program streaming live there. Or you can download TuneIn on your device, on your smartphone, your iPad, your desktop, laptop. TuneIn is a free app. Download the TuneIn app, and in that search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening radio program there. You'll see the icon, and you can listen to the program streaming live, even into your car. That's Time for an Awakening with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. That's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In that Facebook search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you always see interesting content being posted daily. And before you leave that page, just hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook. Also, Time for Awakening Media has been launched. Just put that in your address bar and make that one of your favorites, timeforanawakening.com. That's timeforanawakening.com. It'll take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. There you'll see more interesting articles, blogs, podcasts, programs that you can download, listen at later times, or even share with your friends. So again, make that one of your favorites and put that in your address bar, timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. Tonight, we're scheduled to have a special guest join us, activist, researcher, and historian, Brother Haki Kweli Shakur, will be with us this evening to mark the 25th day of March, marks the International Day of Remembrance for the victims of slavery and the transatlantic slave trade. And tonight, Brother Shakur will be joining us to talk about resistance sites in Virginia and North Carolina, resistance sites of our ancestors. You know, last week we talked with the professor about our people fighting not to have this country founded during the time of 1776. And this is kind of a continuation of that same discussion about resistance of our people in Virginia and North Carolina and some of the sites that Brother Shakur has taken tours to. And we'll talk to him tonight in conversation after we come back after a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies, everybody is here.
You are tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
Not a Wu-Tang-a. All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening with your host, Brother Elliot. Sundays, 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening, and before we get started with our guest this evening, I want to welcome in the co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum here in Philadelphia at 7th and Arch. Brother Richard is joining us. Brother Richard.
Yes, sir. How you doing there, Brother Elliot?
How are you, sir?
I'm excited about, once again, you know, being able to explore another area, another important, well, this remembrance, but another important area in relationship to Africans' resistance and Africans' development in a new world, a new time. And I'm glad that this is a period for us to do that, deal with that remembrance. So Brother Haki is definitely going to help us continue to develop that idea that Professor Horn was kind of developing last week.
Yeah, you know what? That's what I was going to mention. This is a good follow up to what Professor Horn was talking about last week when he talked about it was like a shadow resistance going on that's not talked about in history. When you talk about 1776 and the founding of this country by the European ancestors, that during that same period, it was a resistance going on to the founding of this same country by our ancestors. And we'll talk about that this evening with our guest. He arranges tours down to Virginia and North Carolina to resistance sites, some of them known by some of our people and some of them not so known. But we'll talk about all of them tonight with activist, researcher, and historian, Brother Haki Kweli Shakur. Brother Shakur, are you with us? Brother Shakur, are you there? Brother Shakur? Yeah, we must have, he must not be with us or stepped away, Brother Richard, because he's here.
But yeah, he's, I see.
Yeah, but he's not. It's no problem. We'll just continue the dialogue until he arrives with us. You know, it should be an interesting conversation. I saw several of his videos online of the tour sites that he went to and the discussions that he has. You know, they're brief little snippets. and discussions that he has, interactions with the listeners of the videos, telling the people exactly what went on at the sites. Sometimes the number of our ancestors that were there, and other conversations centering around the sites that he visits. So I think it'll be a lively discussion this evening once he joins us. And until he does, we can kind of just dialogue ourselves, maybe take a call or two until he joins us, or I'll go to a commercial and try to reach out to him because I see that he is here with us. But, well, you know what? That's what I'll do. I think I'll break for a brief commercial. And then when we come back, we should have our guests with us on the line. And then we'll get things started with our guests. You know, depending on how long he stays with us this evening, it's a good chance that we'll break out into open forum later on in the program and just dialogue with the listening audience on some of the issues of today. But until then, yeah. Go ahead, Richard. What'd you say?
No, it sounds good because it's important that because here in Philadelphia they were doing something down at the what is called Congo Square in remembrance to the women of African ancestry and raising that so that. Especially in this time when we're now moving in a different phase of trying to get not just history, but analyze our history and the impact to have this, the moment considered the time of remembrance. I think that's important to our immediate ancestors and to those in the past and what will help us through what I call in the time of Trumpism. So it really is all connected. Of how do we continue to see a project of freedom or liberation or self-sufficiency.
Who organized the gathering at Congo Square?
The UNIA, Universal Negro Improvement Association,
okay.
Division 178. They're holding a, that was at 3 o'clock, they were holding a kind of remembrance of the women of African ancestry that have contributed to just the development in North America since this, I guess, tying into Women History Month and making it, you know, doing that kind of public libation in a place that's historical to Africans of Philadelphia. You know, Congo Square is which they call Washington Square, but it was always a place for African gathering. And taking the term of Congo Square from New Orleans, you know, which was a epic center for where enslaved Africans kind of were brought in and, you know, placed, but also whereas Africans had a certain level of freedom because of the mixture of the different nations, you know, French and Spanish, English, in New Orleans. So that's what they were doing today.
You know, before we take a break, let me try him again. Brother Shakur, are you with us?
Yeah, I'm here.
How are you, sir?
I'm good.
I'm glad to have you with us this evening. We were just kind of going back and forth until you joined us. I seen that you were on the line, but you must have stepped away, but it's no problem.
Yeah.
I'm glad to have you with us this evening. And, you know, before we get started, because I told a listening audience about your work and how you organize the tours to go to the different resistance sites of our ancestors, focusing in on Virginia and North Carolina. Before we talk about some of the sites, some known by folks and some maybe not so well known, before we get into that this evening, talk about yourself, Brother Shakur, briefly. Tell us what got you into the strong desire to visit these sites of our ancestors, whether it was sites of our former enslavement, plantation sites, resistance sites. Talk about the drive that gets you to do this type of work.
What got me really, really, really interested in it is because I've always been like a researcher, like all my life. So like, when I just got kind of fed up with the information not being put out there from where I'm from. So I took it upon myself, because there's so much history in here in Virginia and North Carolina, I decided that I wanted to really delve deeper, because a lot of this information is not in textbooks, it's not in public school curriculums or none of those type of things. So I took it upon myself. I got really interested in it because I came across a book about slave revolts, like I said, like probably in the early 2000s. And like that one book just kind of stuck with me. And the book was by this author by the name of Herbert Alfeeker. And the name of the book was American Negro Slave Revolts. And it was like documented accounts over 250 uprisings in the U.S. South. So when I read that book kind of woke something up in me. And I knew Virginia always had deep history, but I just didn't know how deep it was until I started researching and going to, like, different type of libraries. Because I know this was, like, one of the areas, or where one of the main area where some of our first ancestors were brought to. So that would really make me really go down deeper into it. And so when I started diving deep into it, I just started coming across all types of information that I didn't see in like, the mainstream scholarship. So I took it upon myself to start going to these sites because I wanted to see them for myself. And I wanted to put it out there because I know a lot of our people don't know this history.
Brother Shakur, the history tells us that our ancestors first arrived here. They say 1619. Some historians say between 1600 and 1619, arriving on the mainland here. They arrived in the islands a lot earlier. So you're talking about ground zero of our people's distribution on this mainland, coming in at Virginia, Jamestown in particular. Talk about some of the sites, the kickoff points that some of our people were distributed. And was Richmond or that area a hub for distribution to other southern states early on?
Yeah, Richmond is the main hub. Like, this is like, okay, it's been a little, you know, like discrepancies about where our first ancestors were brought to in Virginia. They said it was Jamestown, but in the last, I feel like the last 5 to 6 years, we had to correct that because they didn't land at Jamestown. They didn't come to Jamestown. They came to an area that's known as Hampton, Virginia. So it's been changed. We don't put up a new marker and everything. Like, those ancestors brought to Hampton. Those, like, those first 20 Africans that were brought here, they were brought to Hampton, Virginia first. But when the slave trade distribution started getting under full throttle, Richmond, Virginia became the trade hub. This is where all the trading was distributed from. It's an area called Shaco Bottom. And, like, this area is where they set up, like, all the auction houses, the auction blocks. I mean, it was over hundreds of auction houses. Like, this area is so historic that it has been compared to the Gori Island on the west coast of Africa in Senegal. Like, over 300,000, 350,000 of our ancestors came through the ports of Richmond and were distributed from the upper south to the deeper south states. This is where they got the majority of their slaves from, was Richmond, Virginia. And right now, to this day, we're trying to get this area memorialized. Like, we're in an ongoing battle that's going on right now to get this area memorialized and more known, because there's a lot of people that's walking around don't even know about this area. And, like, I can guarantee you, like, all the Africans that's in America right now, through my researches, you can track probably at least one of your ancestors back to the Richmond Shaco Bottom area. Because that's how many Africans were being distributed from this area to the deeper south. The only place that's distributing more of our ancestors in this area was the ports of New Orleans at one point. But, like, through the early periods, to like the 18, I said from like the 1700s to like the 1850s, Richmond was the main trade, slave trade hub.
Okay.
Brother, I can and I appreciate the work that again the work you're doing and really working towards finding another way to be to put in place a public historical educational process for those of us who may not be reading or actually are able to take any of the tours that exist, and there is a lot as you're demonstrating you're doing. But also, what I wanted to ask you, as you were saying about Virginia and that being the epicenter as a colony, the question about the what I'm thinking of is how the law changed from those first 20 Africans to make Africans put every African born by birth an enslaved African. Didn't that also occur in, did it occur in Richmond, or did it occur in, well, I forget the name of the place you said where the first 20 Africans, that first found the law?
Oh, yeah, you're talking about Hampton, Virginia. Yeah, Richmond is where Richmond is where that law passed at, because Richmond, Virginia is the capital. Richmond is the capital of Virginia. So, like, Richmond is the main city in Virginia. So, especially during those time periods, like, this is where the government of the colony of Virginia was set up at, Richmond. Richmond passed all, like, the legislation, the first, whatever you want to call it, like, the Congress, the first European Congress there, and the people that was passing the laws in Virginia, in the colony of Virginia, they were stationed in Richmond. So, yeah, the laws that actually made born in, slaves that were, you know, Africa that was born after that certain period of the 20 Africans that came here first, they made it legal that, you know, any African that was born after that point was born a slave. That happened here in Richmond.
Go ahead, Richard.
Go ahead.
Okay, Brother Shakur, the
history
tells us that, because I want to get to Nat Turner, but that came a little later, around 1831. But Gabriel Prosser and his rebellion that didn't come to fruition was in the early 1800s. But from your research, because you've mentioned on several different videos that it was several, at least 25 to 30 different rebellions, and you might have said more, I might be quoting a number wrong, that happened in Virginia and in North Carolina. But was there any rebellions from your research that happened before Gabriel Prosser? And if so, talk about the names of these ancestors. And then I want to kind of delve into Gabriel Prosser.
Okay. Yeah. I say, well, to be honest with you, the resistance from our ancestors, you can basically say it really started immediately after they got here.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, during the late 1600s and the early 1700s, where the first type of we've seen activity of like our ancestors resisting against the European colonials. And several rebellions that took place. But, you know, they eventually got quelled back. But they attempted to, you know, resist against the ancestors. Typically was the area in Norfolk, Virginia and Richmond. See, Richmond had always had, like, slave resistance, like, activity. Like, this was one of the most active areas. This area, and I'll say, like, in the surrounding counties of Richmond, like Henrico, Hampton, Virginia, like Caroline County, and all these type of areas, but really like Norfolk and Richmond, Virginia. I know it's one rebellion that I know for sure. I can't really think of the other ones right now, but I know one specific rebellion was the rebellion in Norfolk. It was like 17, it had to be around like 1770s, something like that. And it was like six of our ancestors, and they planned to rebel and take over Norfolk and then head to Richmond and take over the capital of Richmond. That got pushed back also because of, this is the thing about it. See, a lot of these rebellions, when they some of them got sparked off, but some of them got stopped quickly because, you know, if you trace your history of the slave rebellions and the conspiracy, there's always been a prayer where somebody told on the rebellion, and that stopped the rebellion from going into full mode. So the same thing happened with this Norfolk rebellion. It took off, but eventually it got quelled back because one of the slaves told on the ancestors who tried to rebel. I can't think of their names right now. I got their names in a blog, but I can't really think of their names off the top of their head.
Well, you mentioned two that I was totally unfamiliar with. You mentioned Ann Woods. I think your name was Ann Woods.
Yeah.
And you also mentioned Mingo. Now, I'm not familiar with their rebellions. Maybe you can, the listening audience might, but maybe you can kind of go into those.
Yeah, Mingo. Mingo was a rebellion that don't nobody know about. Like, I was even shocked to find out about this rebellion. And when I came across it, it was very interesting. And this rebellion, as a matter of fact, this was one of the rebellions that took place in the late 1600s.
Okay.
The Mingo Rebellion. And this was in Middlesex County. And what had happened, it was Mingo and like a couple of his comrades, they got fed up with the slave system. And so what they did was, this actually took off. This rebellion actually took off. And when it took off, they killed white folks. They pillaged plantations. They burnt down some of the crops. They stole guns. They raided like a couple of more plantations through Virginia. And then finally, they called in a militia. And when they called in a militia, that's when Mingo and his comrades were captured. And, you know, eventually they were hung. And a couple of his comrades were sold out of Virginia to the deeper south. And also, the Ann Woods was a rebellion that took place in Loudoun County. And I believe that took place in the 1700s also. And what had happened on that rebellion, Ann Woods was an enslaved African. She was born in slavery. And she got, as all our ancestors do, she got fed up with being a slave. And it was these teenagers that she was trying to help escape to get to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, so they can get free. And what she did was help them. So they stole a wagon. They stole a wagon, a horse and a wagon. And when they got the horse and the wagon, it was on their way. And this was part of the Underground Railroad, matter of fact, too. Before the Underground Railroad was even, like, given a name.
Mm-hmm.
So Ann Woods took the horses and took the teenagers. These were teenagers. Matter of fact, Ann Woods was a teenager. And the slave catchers caught up with them. And when they finally caught up with them, teenagers drew down on the slave catchers. And Ann Woods hopped out the horse carriage and drawed her gun on them. And was like, no, we're not going back. And the slave catchers let them go because they didn't want to get into, I guess, a gun battle with them. They did, because they were shocked that these young teenagers had got hold of arms.
Okay.
And so after they drew down on them, they escaped. They eventually made it to Pennsylvania, and they was given their freedom.
Oh, so they did. Okay. All right. Because I had never heard of the story of Ann Woods or Mingo.
Yeah. Ann Woods, the Ann Woods Rebellion, as they call it here, that took place on Christmas Day. That was a Christmas Day rebellion. Like, if you put in, like, Christmas Day slave rebellions, her name will pop up. You'll see it be like Ann Woods.
Okay.
This happened in Loudoun County, Virginia.
Okay. Now, Gabriel Prosser and his brothers, or at least one of his brothers, was in. Was instrumental in organizing a rebellion. The thing that's puzzling to me, and maybe you can kind of help with the dynamic of this, you know, he had access and meetings with a huge number of our enslaved ancestors. Now, when we get up to Nat Turner went around to different plantations because they allowed him to, and he was going around preaching to them until he, had an awakening. But
exactly.
How was Gabriel Prosser able to, I know he was a blacksmith, if I'm not mistaken, but how was he able to be able to network with all of these men? And they said that if his, I think, if I'm not mistaken, that the day that he had planned his rebellion, it was a huge, in fact, it might have been a hurricane at that time, which kind of hampered the men's journey to Richmond. But how were they able to organize that many men? Give me that dynamic. Help our listening audience with that.
Yeah, the Gabriel Prosser Rebellion, as they say, as they said, the history is like, out of all the rebellions, they said this was the best planned rebellion because of what you just mentioned on how did he organize all these people like that? How did he get those many numbers of ancestors? And it's ironic because the people that he was trying to organize stretched all the way from Richmond all the way to North Carolina. So
okay.
He was in touch with ancestors all the way down in North Carolina. And to this day, people are like, well, how in the world did he get in contact with these people like that? And I can't think of his other ancestor name right now. But see, it's another part of that rebellion people don't know about. It's another ancestor who actually started this planning of this rebellion before Gabriel Prosser. And I think his last name might be Valentine, if I'm not mistaken. And like he was the first ancestor who came up with the idea of rebelling against the colony of Virginia and taking over Richmond and ending slavery. So he met Gabriel Prosser, and when he met Gabriel Prosser, he found out how intelligent Gabriel Prosser was. Gabriel Prosser was a little bit more intellectual than he was at that time period for being a slave. So the way he got access to all these other people, like you said, he was a blacksmith. So the slave owner used to hire him out.
Okay, all right.
So Gabriel Prosser was getting jobs from in different areas around Richmond, like the county, like from here to Caroline County. Like it's like any place that he could travel to get work, he could go because he was a blacksmith that could be loaned out. You see what I'm saying? That
okay.
was a job. He could loan out as blacksmith. So him and his brothers, and they don't talk about his brother, and one key figure also is his wife, Nanny. He had a wife called Nanny, and his wife was really the secret weapon of the organizing because she could move around too, because they wasn't really watching females like that at that time period. So she was also on the low, going to different places and telling people to pass the word about this is what's going to happen on this date. We all want to meet at this spot on this date. And I actually visited the spot where they used to meet at, and it's called Bryan Park. It's a little park area. And the place where they meet at, oh, man, it's so powerful where they used to meet at. And they used to hold, little religious ceremonies. Like, it was, it used to be held on Sundays. And so every Sunday they would meet at this creek in this area in Bryant Park. And they would, and I don't know how he got these many ancestors here, but he had ancestors. And it wasn't that many, probably like one person from each county. He had like a person from Caroline County, a person from Waco, a person from North. And I don't know how these people got here, but it's kind of ironic and it's kind of deep. But he'll have like one person come from each county and they'll all meet at this creek. And when they met at the creek, those people would go back to their area, like in north of Caroline County, in these areas, to spread the word. And the word just spread all the way to deep North Carolina that we're going to rebel against Richmond and Virginia on August 30th, 1800. And like you said, the reason why that didn't really take place because it was two other slaves that informed on the whole thing. And also it was like a storm, and they say that the storm was a hurricane.
Yeah.
It flooded like the whole bridge area, the area that I went to on one of my videos. And if you look at the area where I went to, like, you can see where they couldn't cross over there because at that time, it probably ain't had no bridge. So that water had to be over flooded so they couldn't cross over from the right going to Richmond. So that's what ended that rebellion.
Yeah, because I saw a documentary on the public television And they talked about, the white folks even admitted that he had organized over 1,000 men. But the thing that stopped it, even though he was told on by a couple of slaves, they said the real thing that stopped it was that hurricane. Because, like you said, it flooded out areas of the city, and they were unable. They were almost trapped in the areas where they were at.
Yeah, and the rebellion would have, like the two slaves that informed on the rebellion, to this day, from the research that I researched, even though they told, it wouldn't have stopped what he had planned.
That's what that, yeah.
Like it was too well planned. And, like, if that storm would have never took place, that rebellion would have been that rebellion we'll be talking about right now, like we talk about in that term. But way more deep impact, because he organized way more slaves than Nat Turner. You see what I'm saying? So imagine if all those ancestors would have got that word off and that thing would have went in full mode and that storm would have never happened. Man, we'll be talking about different history right about now.
Should we take a couple of years back and look at the point that a lot of those Africans in Virginia were also, in one way or another, assisting with the British in order to, you know, that became that Ethiopian army? I mean, we're talking about 1775, and you're talking about Gabriel Prosser, 1800, so you're only talking about 6 years later. And, you know, as you said, Africans has always been in the mode of resistance, so the organizing seem to have already been in place. The networks have already been in place by the time Gabriel came in, so it was possibly easier to have that kind of number. But after that, it seemed like the fear of the colonists and what they put in place by the time Nat Turner comes in, you know, that's another 30 years later. But, you know, that point of being in those regiments, the British regiments, or at least supporting for that, may have had something to do with that.
Yeah, it did. Yeah, like the British, they had a lot of impact on that. And like even Gabriel Prosser was in contact with the French. Like he met two Frenchmen.
Okay.
And these two Frenchmen was going to help Gabriel with his mission. They gave him his word, and these Frenchmen. And it's ironic because these Frenchmen came from, like, San Domingo, Haiti. They came to Virginia because during that period in time, that's when the British and the French and all of them was in Virginia, you know, the wars and all those type of things cracking off and things like that. And those two Frenchmen came from San Domingo, and from this was, like, after the Haiti Revolution. So when they came there, they seen what Gabriel Prosser wanted to do, and they was going to help him. And the ironic thing, and the key thing I want the listeners and everybody to know about these rebellions and these movements, and the main key thing I want them to know about it is that what these African ancestors were trying to do, what was their goal? Their goal was to return to where they came from, which was Africa. But if they couldn't get back to Africa, they wanted their Africa right here. And what I mean by that is they wanted their own independent nation.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want to be governed by Europeans. Gabriel Prosser wanted his own government right here in Virginia. I got that on record. I got this from my files. He wanted his own black independent nation right here in Virginia. And that's what connects all these different rebellions throughout the South. If you go look at every rebellion from the South, each one was the potential and the goal was to set up an independent nation from Europeans on this land if they couldn't get back to Africa.
And they already had some indication of that when you look at what was going on in Florida earlier,
exactly.
Fort Negro and Fort Mosaic. Which Georgia had to, the colonists of Georgia had to take an offensive on those because they were bringing more and more Africans were able to go to those territory and be able to define their own freedom. I think it's very powerful and important for what you just said in relationship to defining the two strategies, either going home, trying to get home, or creating a space here, which is different than integrating in into a society that, which for Virginia, I assume it was no option.
Yeah, that was no option.
You know, that this conversation really ties in with Professor Horn last week, Richard, when he stated also that the infighting among these early European settlers, and not the settlers, the other European nations, such as the French and British, were ready to supply slaves with weapons to fight these settler colonies. So the rush to organize this 1776 forming of this nation was basically a rush to against slavery, as Professor Horn put it. Okay, great.
And that's an important part also, like with the British, because that brings me to the other area where our ancestor was resisting that, which was the Dismal Swamp. A lot of people don't know about the Dismal Swamp.
You know, Brother Scott, hold off on that, because I want to ask you a question in relation to that, and it'll tie in with Nat Turner. But let me, before I get to that, when they smashed the rebellion of Gabriel Prosser, him and his brothers, and I think it was maybe close to 30 other men, you can correct me if I'm wrong, were hung.
Yeah, 30 men.
And I saw a program, I forgot exactly how long ago, it might have been a couple years ago, and it was a telecast, I think I was down south at the time, and they were talking about a minor league baseball stadium that was going to be built. They had intended to build it over the burial ground of Gabriel Prosser and some of his brothers, and that people in Richmond, some activists, was protesting against it. Whatever happened in relation to that? Or are you aware of what I'm speaking of?
Yeah, I know exactly what you're speaking of. I was a part of that.
Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, like I'm still part of that right now. Like, the last mayor that we had here, which is ironic, he was a black guy.
And he wanted to build over Gabriel Prosser's grave a baseball stadium.
Yeah, Dwight Jones, man, Dwight Jones, a black guy, that really disturbed me. And he was trying to build a baseball stadium over the African burial ground here. And where that African burial ground is located in the area that I was speaking of, far as the Chaco Bottom, in the area where the trade hub was centralized at. The main area, which is Chaco Bottom, and this African burial ground, and it's ironic, it's crazy because some years before that, they had built a parking lot over top of our ancestors' African burial ground for the college university that's here called VCU, and so we had found out about it. We was like, that's an African burial ground. So we started digging more and deeper. Like, yeah, that's a large African burial ground. That's where they used to bury all our ancestors at. It's like, man, it says so many ancestors buried under there, we don't even know the number. And it's also the area where Gabriel Prosser was hung at. And the other 30 comrades were hung at. And they all are buried in this sacred space. And so, and it's ironic because they took part of the gallows that they hung Gabriel Prosser with, and they made that part of the highway that's going over top of the African burial ground. It's part of the African burial ground today. If you come to Richmond today, I can show you. It's part of the African, part of the highway that's going over the African burial ground. But as far as the relations on what's going on with it today, matter of fact, Monday, March 27th, we go back to City Hall for it, and we got a new mayor. She, that's what put a little standstill on the progress of it, because we got a new mayor. But far as the stadium is no longer getting built.
Okay.
Too many people in Richmond voted against it, and, you know, our protesting and all those type of things, it basically shut that down. So as it was stands today, we go back in there on March 27th, and we're trying to get this whole big memorial park built, because actually we got a Richmond slave trail here also. We got the trail that they boats docked at is also a historic site. It's a long trail all the way off the James River that takes you all the way off the docks, and it takes you all the way down into the city, into Chaco Bottom. And that's a historic site that we got to get memorialized also. So that whole area where the warehouses used to be, the auction houses, the African burial ground, all those things we take into the mayor and city hall Monday to get this thing done. Because this so-called mayor claimed that he's for the memorial park to get built. So we're going to find out.
Okay.
Can I ask Brother Akeem, in these actions, and I kind of ask it all the time because it's like so important, and I'm wondering from the political organizing, you know, using our African burial grounds, using our historical sites, do they truly help in politicizing us as African people, and or do you see in your area from your work that people become more conscious, therefore become more politically active because they can identify with these the burial ground and sites and recognize how the importance, and that's why, you know, they can, these stops happen? Or is it just left to the whim of the political officer of the time, in your opinion?
I would say far as Richmond, I think we got like a long road to go in that area, because here in Richmond, I would have to say, like, the people, our people, speaking far as our people, they're not educated on it. And it's crazy because all this took place in our city, and there's too many of our people here that don't know about it. I mean, they're starting to know about it now because of people like me and my comrades and a couple of other organizations around here. And to be honest with you, those numbers are in the minority numbers, because there's not many of us from either organization around here that's putting this information out here. We don't really have numbers like that. The only other people that really knows about this stuff like that is, I would have to say, like the university that's central in Virginia, which is VCU. Now, they got courses and things like that in their school, but even they still not teaching this history. You see what I'm saying? So, matter of fact, I just did an interview with VCU about certain aspects of the history in Richmond, Virginia, that they're not teaching in public schools. See, now a lot of our kids that's walking around, teenagers and all these type of things, they don't know nothing about this history. And it's crazy because Chaco Bottom is right here in the city, and they don't even have a curriculum in these public schools in Richmond and the surrounding counties about the slave trade. You know what I'm saying? And, you know,
yes.
No, go ahead.
And, you know, Elliot, the reason, and, you know, that this becomes so important, because when we look at the, say, the police mass shooting, we know we can tie the behavior of these kind of officers directly to the culture, and in this case, in North America, the slave society. And as you're saying, Virginia is the birthplace. I mean, South Carolina has its side, but Virginia is the birthplace to the slave society, to the slave economy.
Exactly.
And, you know, and to not have people make the, when we can't be able to help make that connection, or we need to continue to think through how do we take these activities and the actions that you're doing and make the connection so it helps in the political organizing around that.
And I would have to say that's the main area that I'm trying to work on, like, because it's not enough of us here in Richmond that's really organizing that and putting that into full motion, because it's needed here. Like I've been telling a lot of people here, man, like, that's a reason for a lot of oppression that's going on in Richmond, because Richmond has a high crime rate, a high murder rate, and a high, you know, how can I put it, a high, like, racist society here. And a lot of things that's happening today in Richmond, when I go back into the history here, I can point out in our ancestors' slave history, just like you just said with the police shooting. And I be telling people all the time, I'm like, I'm here in the state and city where this originated at. I can show you the origin of these cats' behaviors. You see what I'm saying? And it's, you know, we gotta do more. We gotta do more in Richmond. We gotta organize better. That's it. because organizing here right now is not on a good level. And the education level on our history here is not on a good level right now.
Brother Shakur, let's take it up to Nat Turner. Some people, you know what, and let me say this before we talk about my answer to Nat Turner. You know, I was surprised, and I shouldn't be surprised. I was kind of surprised at how many people did not know anything about Nat Turner when the brother just put that movie out, Birth of a Nation, last summer. And people started talking about it, and I became aware that a lot of people didn't know anything about Nat Turner. Now, one portion in the movie that stuck out to me, and I want you to go into this because you attempted to go into it a minute ago. One portion of the movie that stuck out to me was near the end when it showed that Nat walked into the town and gave himself up, and, you know, he was beaten and later hung. But I read accounts, historical accounts, that Nat was in that dismal swamp for several months before they found him. Now, you were about to talk about the Maroon communities that were in the swamp. Am I right that Nat was in the swamp, living in the swamp among brothers and sisters, but when a lot of the killing, because a lot of people were killed behind that rebellion, and, you know, when Nat was basically found in the swamp, was he found among the Maroon community? Give me that dynamic, because I do know that what they showed in the movie was inaccurate near the end. But go ahead.
Yeah, that was very inaccurate. And from my research, I would have to co-sign that, because I've seen on several cases where they said that he was in a dismal swamp.
Okay.
And he was hiding in the dismal swamp. But see, what had happened is when them Europeans got a hold of his, got a hold of that story of Nat Turner, and you know how the Europeans do, how they sabotage and change the history. They tried to say that he was found hiding in the woods close to where the rebellion sparked off at in Southampton County, which I don't know if that's true or not, because it's coming from a European perspective.
Okay.
But there's other evidence that's showing us that he made it to the Dismal Swamp.
Mm-hmm.
And he made it to the Maroon community that was in the Dismal Swamp. And what he was trying to do was, again, like I stated earlier, they wanted to turn that area into an independent nation, a black nation. I've seen evidence of that recently also, where Nat Turner actually was speaking on a black nationalist level. Like, he wanted that area to become a new African nation. And I would have to say the point that you just said about when they started killing all the innocent Africans, and they started killing all the innocent ancestors and all those type of things, because it's like I said, Nat Turner also had a far-reaching organizing to North Carolina, like the northern part of North Carolina, because the Dismal Swamp stretched into North Carolina also. So his rebellion and his organizing skills also reached all the way into North Carolina. So he had people there that was going to set off rebellion. Well, actually, some of them participated in that rebellion in parts of North Carolina that's not talked about. Like when that Turner rebellion sparked off, you had ancestors in North Carolina killing white slave owners also on the same date. And so all of them was trying to get to the Dismal Swamp. But
okay.
I would have to say, like you just said, I would have to say by the militia being called in and the way the militia was just brutalizing and murdering our innocent ancestors, killing kids, killing women, killing people who had nothing to do with the rebellion. I think that's what made Nat Turner turn himself in.
Okay. Yeah, because I did read several historical accounts where he was in that dismal swamp for several months after that rebellion was, you know, had been quelled. But after
the reason why those accounts are known, those came from black researchers here.
Okay.
And when those black researchers found out about that, they forced the Europeans here to like, whoa, like hold on, like this is records. We got like certain records that's showing that he made it to the Dismal Swamp. So now you got certain Europeans who are agreeing with that historical account more than the other historical account of him being found close to Southampton. Like, they try to say he was hiding like 15 miles away from where the rebellion sparked off at in some woods, which I don't believe that account, because that came from like a European.
Okay.
So Brother Hacking, can you kind of help us? Because I seen something about 10 generations of people who are been living in the Dismal Swamp. And as you said, that they were considering even, you know, creating sovereignty or a nation. So when did this Maroon community begin, and how were they living? I understand the swamp areas. I'm not too familiar what a swamp area is, but can you kind of help us like flush out how could a people be living there and still be untouched for such a long time in that large tract of land?
Well, from my research in the historical accounts, they said that people started living in the Great Dismal Swamp around the 1630s. So that was like in the early parts of when the slave society was being implemented in the colony. So this is what they say. They were saying that like the Native Americans, they say it was Native Americans that was already living in the Dismal Swamp. And so you can kind of get an idea of how, you know how the Native peoples are already living. You know, they live off the land. They live off, even though it's a swamp and all those type of things, you know, they could survive because they were already spiritually and physically in tune with nature and already prepared for that type of living. They was already living that way because you already know how the accounts of how the Indians were living. The Africans, the first evidence of Africans making it to the Dismal Swamp and living amongst the Native Americans was in the early 1700s. And some say even earlier than that. They're trying to say some of our ancestors made it to the Dismal Swamp like in the late 1640s and those type of time periods. But they get a historical account that they made it there in the 1700s. And what these ancestors were doing, they were running away from plantations in Southern Virginia. And when they found out about the Dismal Swamp, it's kind of like they organized it. It's like the Indians helped organize it. Like, if you make it here, you got sovereignty. Mm-hmm. And so the reason why that got set up like that was resistance. The Indians and the Africans, they were killing Europeans who tried to come into the swamp. If you got anywhere near that vicinity, you got killed. The Indians took them out. The Africans took them out. So, like, it got so bad at one time that they was killing so many Europeans, and the Europeans were trying to bring the militias down in there, and they held up so much of a high resistance that George Washington and all of them, they had to call some backup from other countries to try to help them get the Maroons out of the swamp. But that never happened, though. It never manifested. So, over the years, George Washington just kept trying. He just kept sending militias in there, trying to remove them. They failed over and over again. And matter of fact, one of those great ancestors, I want to call his name out right now, is a Maroon, an African Maroon, who was the leader of the Black Maroons in the Dismal Swamp, which is Bob Fayrabee. And he's a well-known Maroon leader of the Great Dismal Swamp. And he was captured in June 25th, 1825. This was after years and years and years of guerrilla warfare against George Washington and his militias.
You know, we're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, you can join the conversation at 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're in conversation with activist, researcher, and historian Brother Haki Kweli Shakur. And again, we'll be right back.
Tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
Hey, did y'all see the stuff I posted on my wall?
No, it didn't even show up in my news feed.
Man, I'm done with social media. All the injustice and brutality going around, and it's like they're trying to suppress our voice. We're trying to get the message out there, and you can't even share empowerment and what's going on around the country either.
Nah, don't be dumb with social media, though. It's a tool, and there is a place where we have a voice. It's a Let's Buy Black 365 social network. You do anything you would on any other social network. Post pictures, videos, status updates, share resources and community news. But on Let's Buy Black 365, it's a platform for us and by us to tell our messages.
Whoa, that's like a digital underground railroad.
What's the name of that site again?
It's letsbuyblack365.com.
Yeah, I heard about that. It's all about networking, and you get points, right?
Yeah, the more you network, post, and share, the more points you get. Plus, you get points for posting pictures, sharing information, attending community events, and inviting others to network with you on the app.
Wow, that's all I need to know. I'm gonna go download that app right now.
Now, better yet, let me invite you so I can get some points. It's all about empowerment and solutions, y'all.
Yeah, that's what's up. I'm all in.
Let's do it. Let's share our stories.
Let's buy Black365.com.
What is in 1 million brothers and sisters who are tired of the same old rhetoric, the same old leaders, the same old ways of dealing with political and economic empowerment? You realize that nobody's going to save black people but us if you understand that no existing political party prioritizes the best interests of African Americans as a collective. If you believe that leadership is as leadership does, and this means that the best leaders for the black collective must come from the ranks of those who place and hold the best interests of black people foremost and uttermost. If you understand that black people must develop the mindset and the will to finance their own racial uplift organizational efforts, then get involved with 1 million conscious black voters and contributors. The movement is now. Go to www.iamoneofthemillion.com. That's www.iamoneofthemillion.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. And before we go back to our guest, activist, researcher, and historian, Aki Kwela Shakur, we're talking about the resistance of our ancestors and the historic sites that our guest arranges for our people to view and to see in Virginia and in North Carolina, which was basically ground zero of our ancestors coming to this mainland society that we know now as the United States of America. I want to play a clip for our listening audience before we go back to our guests. Let me see if I can find it. Here we go.
It's in history. For the first time ever, divers have uncovered the wreckage of an African slave trade ship that sunk with slaves on board. The Portuguese ship, called the São José, left the coast of Mozambique in December 1794, bound for Brazil, with about 400 to 500 enslaved Africans packed inside. 24 days later, the ship went down off the coast of Cape Town with half of them still trapped inside. The wreckage sat at the bottom of the sea, untouched until a team of treasure hunters located in the 1980s. Well, for the first 5 years, a team of researchers and archaeologists have quietly worked to recover the artifacts, many of which have remained remarkably intact. Now, some of those artifacts representing the earliest days of the slave trade are heading to the United States, and they will be displayed at the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture when it opens next year. And joining me now, the director of the museum, Lonnie Bunch. Lonnie, it's so great to have you on. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
And we talked about the treasure hunters who located it in the 80s. What was that process like? How did they, or what drew them to that site?
Well, I think that this is a site that's near the Cape of Storms, so a lot of ships have gone down, and I think treasure hunters always felt that they could find some, you know, some gold or something very important, and when they couldn't, they kind of left it alone. But we were fortunate to be able to work with the best scholars to revisit the site, to do the research, and to be sure that it is the São José.
When they discovered what they believed to be the ship, there were a few key things that you told me that indicated that it was human cargo on board that ship, including weights that were used on these ships, because bodies and humans weigh and shift boats differently than if this were cargo of fruit or other things.
That's exactly right, that they use an iron ballast, and often there was an equal number of iron ballast to the number of people that they put on board. And so one of the telltale signs of a slave ship is that it has this kind of ballast, because human cargo doesn't have the weight that, say, wood does or metal.
And what do we know happened that day? I know that some of the men and women who were enslaved and on that ship, they were saved, and not because their lives were precious as humans, but because they were cargo and they meant money.
That's exactly right. As the ship was hitting the rocks and was going down, there was a great effort to rescue the cargo because they were worth so much money to the owners. And ultimately what happens is that all the crew and almost half of the enslaved people are rescued, but half perish when the ship goes down. But what is even more painful is those that are rescued are then sold 2 days later from Cape Town and dispersed throughout South Africa.
And this has been a delicate balance, is that we want to show people these artifacts here in the United States and bring them to this museum that you've given your life and soul to curate, but also for those of Mozambique and what this means for them to have this ship recovered.
What was so powerful to me is that I spent the last couple of weeks in Mozambique and in Cape Town, and I went to an area of the Makua people, and these are the people, many of who were on this ship. And some of the village elders then actually gave us soil that they wanted me to take back and sprinkle over the site of the wreck, because as the chieftain said, this will finally allow our people to rest in peace in their homeland.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. We're in conversation tonight with activist, researcher, and historian Haki Kwela Shakur. March 25th marks the International Day of Remembrance of Victims of Slavery and the Transatlantic Slave Trade. That clip that you heard was a clip from about a year ago about the Portuguese slave ship, the San Jose, that went down with 500 of our ancestors shackled to the bottom. And you heard the clip that it was basically still intact. I guess the bones of Isis had disintegrated, but all the artifacts and all was still intact in this ship. You know, when you hear stories like that, it just lets you know the kind of people that brought our ancestors here were the animals. Words can't express my feelings when I hear stories like that in reference to our ancestors, but let's get back to our conversation. I wanted to play that, Brother Richard and Brother Shakur, for our listening audience to hear in reference to that ship that was salvaged with some of our ancestors still shackled to the bottom 300 years later. Brother Shakur, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, good. Brother Richard.
Yes, I hope. It's tough, you know, and I have to, Brother Shakur, Brother Saki, what reminds me that takes my mind to the correlation which you said earlier, because Virginia had so many Africans brought to that land that was placed under probably the most harshest kind of inspection, and definitely those plantation life was so harsh that so many died. So we're hearing about those who died underwater, but what you were speaking about when you talk about the African burial ground, how many that you can't even count the numbers in a place that had so many Africans living there and working, and they worked them to death. I don't, you know, the correlation is just astonishing.
You know, we got a couple calls on hold, but before we go to the callers, I want to bring it up to after the Civil War, Brother Shakur, and the devastation of the city of Richmond, because I think during, and I'm no European history historian, but I think Richmond was the capital when they kind of the war against the North and South. I think Richmond was their capital, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, Richmond was the capital of the Confederate States.
So yeah. After the war against the Confederates, and Richmond was devastated, so to speak, and our ancestors were free, we went into the city. We established neighborhoods. You talk about in several of your videos the Jackson Ward, the Black Wall Street that started in the 1880s. Talk about those areas, the things that were going on that were established through agriculture, through some of the ingenuity of our ancestors. Talk about the thriving metropolis that was established in Richmond in the black areas.
Yeah, Jackson Ward, Black Wall Street. Yeah, that's another place that nobody really knows about in the black community. So, and it's even terrible because we didn't really know about that here in Richmond as I was growing up. I mean, I knew about, the only person we really knew about in that time period that they mentioned was Maggie L. Walker.
Mm-hmm.
And Maggie L. Walker she's like the most popular one from that period. And I'm going to take you back to the origin, which was went out of, you know, like I said, after the Civil War destroyed Richmond. During that period, when they were rebuilding Richmond, a lot of our people, you know, they stayed in the city and they moved around the city. During these time periods, they started formulating and getting together, and, you know, the little money that they were making off of the things they were doing, because we all know after our ancestors were released after slavery, you kind of could say that slavery really never ended. Because when they was released out of slavery, the conditions were so bad and so harsh that a lot of our ancestors didn't even make it after that period, which was the Reconstruction period. So during the Reconstruction period, this is when you can see that your first ancestors were starting to think economically on a high level. So that's when the Freedmen's Bureau was first set up here in Richmond. And through that Freedmen's Bureau is when these ancestors started thinking on the level of self-determination and starting to do things for themselves. And one specific ancestor who came from Georgia and came from Tennessee and made his way to Richmond, Virginia, was William Washington Brownie. And when William Washington Brownie got to Richmond, there was this organization called the Order of Two Reformers Order. And this was a fraternity of black ancestors who put their money together and built up banks. And so the first bank in the United States history that was established by a black man and black people was the William Washington Brownie called the True Reformers Bank. And this bank was formed in like 1889. And this is the first bank to ever be established in the history of the United States by a black person. And so after that, you had people like, Johnny Mitchell Jr., Dallas Jackson, Maggie L. Walker, which was the St. Luke Order. And it's ironic because it was Maggie L. Walker. Also, I can't forget this name, Richard L. Chancellor. He's another great ancestor. All these great people got together. Despite little certain disagreements that they had with each other, they all had one goal and one goal only, and that was to be a self-determined people and build up a self-determined community, which came in existence with Jackson Ward, Black Wall Street. And matter of fact, this was the first area that was called Black Wall Street. See, a lot of people think Tulsa, Oklahoma was the first Black Wall Street, and it wasn't. Tulsa wasn't even in existence when Jackson Ward was thriving.
Okay.
We had over seven independent black banks here that were owned by black people. Johnny Mitchell had a bank, which was called a Mechanic Savings Bank. R.F. Chancellor had his own bank, which was called a Nickel Savings Bank. And all this was between, like you said, 1880s to like the early 1900s. This was even before Marcus Garvey got in full swing. And so you had Maggie L. Walker, the first black woman to open up a bank.
Mm-hmm.
The St. Luke's Penny Savings Bank, which was opened in 1903. I believe it's 1903 or 1905 in that year. And so this area was, the dollar wouldn't lead its community at all. And they built up so much wealth. We had grocery stores. We had like over 100 something grocery stores, barber shops, vegetation spots where you can get, vegetation vegetables. We had all types of places, our own independent schools. And this lasted for like over 3 to 4 decades, from like 1880s to like 1940s. This place thrived. And it thrived so much that it was nicknamed the Harlem of the South, the Black Mecca of Commerce, the first place of black capitalism.
Let's grab a couple of callers. Let's go to 404 area code. 404 area code. What's your name? Where you calling from?
Hey, this is Wes calling from the ATL, man.
How are you, sir?
Hey, yes, sir. I've been doing some research on the first people that was already over here, the black people that look like me and you, and see, they kind of keep that them people hid, man. But I found out their name was the Almaroon. Okay, and they tricking people by talking about some maroon. They were called the Almaroon. All right, them the ones that walked over when the continent was whole before this the flood. But they called the Almaroon. And right now I'm still digging in and researching on them. It's hard to find research. And the other people that was already here, the ones down south with them big head statues, they were called the Olmec Chief, okay? And these damn Europeans flipped the name of that and came up with Mexico. That's how they flipping the words in the language, see? And I'm just doing research on this, my brother, and on them Almaroons, because you're right, man. When Nat Turner them, all them, I hear it in the woods, they were hanging out with the Almaroons. And they were the ones that was already over here, all on this side of the world, and I'm still researching on them. And all them out of one of them tribes out of Israel, man. Okay, the IMOU. All right. There it is right there. And the other ones they brought, this other ones that escaped from on the north from when the temple got tore down. Then the ones they brought over here in slavery. All right. And so it's just still deep, and the information coming out. My brother, peace and blessing. I love y'all, Elliot. You bring it, busting them in the head with your knowledge, man. I let somebody talk. Let's see what my brother got to say.
Thank you for your call, sir.
Yes, sir.
Let's go to 602. 602 area code. What's your name? Where you calling from?
Yes, brother. This is Brother Marcus from Memphis.
How are you, Marcus?
I'm doing great. I'm doing great. It's great to hear this good history about resistance, you know, of our people. Because if you read the European history book, you know, a lot of these, they're not going to tell us, which we know that. We know they're not going to tell us because that's going to give us courage and make us arrogant, you know, make us proud, you know. But it's, you know, it's ironic because even in our songs, because the historian was just pointing out what happened in Jamestown, Virginia, you know, the slave ship, the name of the ship was the Good Ship Jesus. And if you listen to the Negro spirituals, they said they used to sing that song, "Steal away, steal away to Jesus." That's what they were saying. They're not talking Jesus in the sky. They're talking about that slave ship, getting back on that slave ship to get back to their motherland. So that memory was still in our people's mind, you know. And I really don't think we're going to solve our problem here in America. You know, as much as our people love America, we're not going to solve our problem here. History has demonstrated that, because every time we build something up, they destroy it, because they are the majority of the population in this country, and we are encircled. They're not going to give us no separate homeland here in America, you know. So, you know, we really need to look at Mr. Garvey's program, embrace, you know, we know that everybody ain't going to go back to Africa, but the theme is Africa for the Africans, those at home and those abroad. You know, take care, good brothers.
Marcus, thank you as always for your call.
All right.
Brother Shakur?
Yeah.
you heard Brother Marcus. He kind of echoed some of your sentiments earlier.
Yeah.
let's grab another call here to 267. 267 area code. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
Yes, Brother Timothy, Brother Elliot.
How are you, sir?
Good. How are you? How are you, Brother Richard?
Good. How are you yourself?
Good. Brother Shakur, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great.
I like your research. I've been off and on this book called The History of the Indians in the United States. You might want to check it out, you brothers, by Angie DeBow. And she gives a good account of the Sentinel Indians in Florida, speaking of the swamps, in which the European could get up in the swamps, and our people left the plantations, all in Florida, to join them. And any time the Europeans tried to get up in there, they got their butts whipped. They couldn't deal with the natural environment of the alligator, of the swamp, of the disease. And just like yourself, Elliot, looking at a program on PBS one time, they had to build bridges, modern-day bridges, just to walk across one area to the next. So you can imagine how they did the best that they could in whipping the Europeans behind them there. But this woman gives a very good account of the history. I'm in and out of the book. I've been in and out of the book for many years because I never got a chance to finish it. But she's really good. She has a good book on Geronimo, too. Now, this young lady received her PhD in history from the University of Oklahoma, and some of her many works on Geronimo, the man, and pick it up. Come back with us, man. And I like the research on the rebellions from some parts of the South to the Deep South. We need to know about the history, man. We need to keep that fire going so we can rebel today like we rebelled yesterday.
Exactly.
That's what I'm talking about, brother. Keep it going.
Brother Tim?
I appreciate that.
Thank you for your call, man. And if we get a chance to go into open forum, you can call back when we're open forum later on in the program.
Oh, yeah, brother. We got a lot to talk about in the city of Philadelphia, don't we?
Peace.
Talk to you.
All right. Brother Shakur, the You know, you mentioned in some information that you sent me a Dred Scott memorial, and I was kind of thrown because, you know, all I knew was Dred Scott dealing in Missouri, you know, doing the decision and all when he went back to get his wife. And he crossed back into Missouri and they tried to put him back into enslavement. I didn't know that Dred Scott came from Southampton County, Virginia.
Yeah. A lot of people don't know that. And, you know, it's ironic because he's from the same place that Turner from.
Okay.
That's where he was. That's where he grew up as a slave. He was enslaved on a plantation in Southampton County. And they got the big marker on his childhood house where he was enslaved at.
You know, I mean, it's the more bits and pieces that you hear, the more, you know, we're responsible. We got to take the responsibility for our children not knowing these things about our ancestors. And this is not like it's ancient history. This is stuff that happened since we've been on these shores that we don't know. A lot of these men gave their lives, and they didn't give their lives to be assimilationists or integrationists. They gave their lives for freedom. They wanted freedom. They wanted total freedom. I mean, we need to know about these men, reverence them. Every other nationality reverence their elders, and they make sure you know about their elders or their people that they reverence. We don't even know about some of our people, so we can't tell other people about them. We know about people that they allow us to know about. We need to know the hidden history of some of these people that they try to keep hidden. You know, that little clip I played, it said that they discovered that boat in the 1980s, in the 1980s, and spent 5 years looking at the stuff. I mean, what are you trying to hide? Why would you spend 5 years looking at what's going on before you reveal it to the quote-unquote public? I mean, this man is always a treachery, something behind his sleeve, a hidden hand, something going on. Come on here.
One thing that this, the work that you're doing, Brother Hakeem, helps us do, and, you know, I think it's two thoughts I would like to put out it because I think we should look at history as a part of analyze history from a military science perspective. And especially when we're looking at the Maroon communities and as you've been saying, these Maroon communities have been their principal project in North America is about self-sovereignty. It wasn't about trying to convince or trying to show or trying to work with your Americans. And as we said earlier, they didn't even have that opportunity at that time, and that was the most harsher moments. But that project of being able to say, we're going to get to a place, and obviously had to create the social network to where we can be able to do the things to be self-sufficient. And then you give another example in Jackson War of that tradition carrying on even under different times. One thing that I like to get from you, though, as you – because I think this is the power and the importance of the history and people like yourself being able to take us through things. As you are gathering this information about these different events happening in an area that you grew up in, you thought you know, how did it change your thinking, or how did your thinking align with their thinking? Because as we should be looking at history as a way to communicate directly, so it's influencing us. So I'm asking, how did looking at what they did, what they were able to do, the conditions they were going through, how did that impact you as an individual in shaping the way you're thinking on what you have to do?
I would say because... For one, anyway, let me make it this point. Because first of all, let me say this: I'm a conscious New African. I'm a part of the New African Independence Movement, which is the Republic of New Africa. And what the Republic of New Africa is our nation, that we, that our ancestors, that were comrades of El Hajj Melis Baz. And see, my mentors and all my elders come from this. They come from this movement. So I was taught most of this stuff through my elders of the New African Independence Movement, because our whole thing is sovereignty. And our whole thing is slave resistant history, because we teach each other this is who we are. This is, these are the ancestors we manifest from, and this is the tradition we must keep going. So when the Republic of New Africa was founded, it wasn't where it was founded in 1968, but we, like Mutulu Shakur taught me, the New African Independence Movement was founded the day our ancestors started resisting when they got off that boat. A nation was being formed as soon as they got off that boat. A nation was formed when the first slave revolt took place. You know what I'm saying? So my whole training of thought is sovereignty, independence, because integration would never work for African people in America. It would never work because we came from different nations already that were sovereign. Even the people like the brother said when he called in, even the Africans that were already over here, they were sovereign people. So this is my mindset. This is why I study this stuff so much. This is why I research it so much, because it does help me there, because it helps me in my life as far as being an independent New African man and spreading this information to other New Africans in the United States to show them that you have other ancestors that they haven't taught you about, that's showing you our true traditions, our true beliefs, our true destiny, which is true freedom, to be independent, not to be integrationist. See, when they hear that word separatist, it's been taught to our people wrong. They think of the separatism of the racist white man. That's a different type of separatism. Our separatism wasn't like the white man's separatism. Theirs was forced separatism. Ours was sovereign separatism, because we always lived that way. See, that's the hardest part of trying to get that in our people's heads, is that they've been taught and brainwashed one side of the story about one set of our ancestors. yeah, we had ancestors who didn't know no better, and they was brainwashed by the white man to be integrationist. You see what I'm saying? But what about the ancestors who didn't want to integrate? This is where I come into the picture at. You see what I'm saying? With what I'm trying to do in Richmond, Virginia. Like, my people in Richmond, Virginia, I can guarantee you right now, 85% to 90% of my people don't know none of this history right here. They don't know, all they know is the integrationist history. So this is what I feel like is my destiny.
And it's important and powerful that what you just said, because Elliot, you know, I always say there are different projects of African people in North America, and it's just as you said, Brother King, they're not emphasizing, or we don't emphasize, and we're doing the work, the project of true self sufficiency, of true self sovereignty. And again, to appreciate the work that you're doing towards that end.
I appreciate it.
Real Haki, two things I want to touch on before we wind things down. Tell our listening audience about Mr. John Mitchell Jr.
Great man.
Now, he, the newspaper that he started, the name escapes me.
The Richmond Planet.
Okay. And he was the editor and owner during the time of the Red Summer. The, what was that, 1918, I think, when they were lynching, burning towns and lynching our ancestors, as many as they could get their hands on. They were trying to string them from the highest tree. But talk about his impact with his paper and the things that he did.
John Mitchell Jr., man. That's like my elders even
mentioned this to me the other day because they were so happy to see my video about John Mitchell Jr. And they was like, wow, somebody finally is talking about John Mitchell Jr. John Mitchell Jr., he needs to be implemented in every aspect of African education in America to our people. This was a good man. Like, John Mitchell Jr., I think he is the epitome of what our ancestors were after they came out of the Civil War. Because his whole mind state was to get our people back into the tradition of what my brother just spoke about online, about being a self-sufficient, sovereign people. And he lived his life daily trying to make all this manifest. And he manifested it for a good time because, like I said before, this man started his own bank, which was the Mechanic Savings Bank. He built housing for our people. He helped build Jackson Ward. He helped a lot of our people who just had, and he was born enslaved. So that tells you and shows you that you can accomplish the things that we were seeking to accomplish when we were born here, because he set up the paper, which was the anti-lynching paper, and it also was a paper that was emphasizing self-determination, economics. And one of the main things that he was emphasizing was self-defense and teaching our people it's cool, and as a matter of fact, it's sane for you to protect yourself and to defend yourself from these racist Europeans that's coming into our city and coming into our neighborhoods and killing and lynching our people. So he's like one of the first people that was teaching on self-defense. And many people don't even know about this guy at all. And also the Richmond Planet paper emphasized, this is where the first time we've seen in history that the word black power was used. That you've seen later in the years with the Black Panther Party and the Loudoun County Freedom Party in Mississippi. A lot of people think Stokely Carmichael and these people came up with the term black power, which is, you know, they did, but we could take the origin all the way back to John Mitchell Jr. because he published it on the front of his paper, black power, farming. He emphasized black farming, revolutionizing black farming. Our people need to get land. He put the importance on getting land, which is another key thing that we need to teach our babies and teach our people about land. We need to own land, because if we don't have no land, we can't be no self-determined, independent people. And we're always going to be in a situation where we're in because we don't have no land. We can't even feed ourselves. And John Mitchell Jr. emphasized feeding our people and revolutionizing black farming.
Brother Shakur, you know, you're a young man yourself. It looks to me that you're maybe 40 or less. Am I right?
Yeah.
You talked about, because we see the situation that our people find themselves in, living in 2017 in the United States. A lot of the major cities, they're being gentrified. The schools are shutting down in a lot of these major cities. The prison industrial complex, or the new slavery, is in full effect. And the only opportunities that is engineered by Europeans for our people, and it's a trap, is to get them involved in some type of criminal enterprise or criminal activity that'll end them up in shackles again. You mentioned in a video that the chore now, or the major task now, is transforming the criminal mentality into a revolutionary mentality. Talk about what you meant when you said that and how this can be accomplished in 2017 moving forward.
Transforming the criminal mentality into a revolutionary mentality. What I mean by that is that's coming from a long tradition of my elders, which I, you know, I mentioned Tulu Shakur, all the political prisoners that I advocate for, and all these great people who at one point of time in their life, Tanya Shakur, my other mentor, I can't forget him, George Jackson, the list can goes on of people, Stanley Tukey Williams, and a whole other list of others. It's just a tradition of how we see of how these people went from being criminals to productive New African revolutionaries and having a positive effect on our community. So, and to be honest, and I hate to say this, but the prison industrial complex has produced some of our best brothers, our best revolutionaries, our best transformed new human beings, productive human beings in these slave camps across the United States of America, like George Jackson. So what we mean by transforming the criminal mentality to a revolutionary mentality is just simply saying that we're trying to eliminate the colonized mind, the colonial subject mind, and transforming that into a productive African mind. And how do we go about doing that? We have to get back out here in these streets, man. We have to get in contact with these street organizations. We have to reach our kids before they even get to the point of wanting to even indulge in street life. We must grab our sons. We must grab our daughters. We must grab the males and the females who are already in the street life. And we have to show them this history that we talked about tonight. Because if you can teach our people about this history that we're talking about tonight, as far as being a resistant African, a sovereign African, because it all boils down to identity. These people are out here committing crimes because they have no identity of who they are. They don't even know where they come from. They don't even know the ancestors they descend from. So I'm saying by transforming the criminal mentality into a revolutionary mentality, we must go back, Sankofa, and show them. We know they might not even know about the great history of Africa, but I think we can even start with just the ancestors' rights here, because we tend to forget about the ancestors' rights here who resisted, and the ancestors who created these great civil these great communities over the history, like Jackson Ward, Black Wall Street. They don't know nothing about none of this stuff. I can tell you that right now because I even delved in the street life and street organizations. And I can tell you right now, these people out here don't know nothing about Black Wall Street, Jackson Ward, and all these type of great things their ancestors accomplished when they got out of slavery and the resistance movement. So I'm saying that we have to show them. We must show them about who they are. They need to find out who their identity are. Because if they don't have the identity, they're going to continue to fall for the traps of the white supremacist system. They're going to continue to go to the new slavery, slave camps, because they don't know who they are. So that is my emphasis on why we must transform the criminal mentality to a revolutionary mentality. It's all about self-identity.
You know, I want to thank you for being with us this evening, Brother Shakur. I'm going to be reaching out to you in the future. To talk about some of these issues, to talk about some of the new discoveries. We didn't get a chance to talk about a lot of different other sites that you had been to. But before you leave us this evening, give out any information you want to in reference to if somebody's coming that way, how they can reach you, how they can go on some of the tours, visit some of the sites. Go ahead. The floor is yours.
They can reach me at my email. My email is HockeyShakur83@gmail.com, or they can reach me on Facebook at HockeyCurtyShakur. I'm on basically all the social media sites. You can get me, they can catch me on Twitter, Hockey_K_Shakur, Instagram, same thing, Hockey_Curtie_Shakur. But they can check out my site on some of the things we discussed tonight. I have all this information on my site, which is New African 77. www.wordpress.com so they can follow up on some of the information that we talked about tonight. I have a whole lot of information on the slave rebellions on my website. And that's basically it. They can catch me on all my social media sites and my email.
Brother Richard?
Brother Akeem, you can. Well, I know that I'm going to get down to Virginia to go on your tour. You know, I kind of just, I'm going to call it the pilgrimage, not even a tour, right? And can you, that's New African, the website again?
New African 77. WordPress.com.
Dot WordPress. Because it's so important that the work that you're doing, and you know, the continuation of that. You exemplify that intergenerational transmission of information about the position that we have, that it's no other solution but our own national self-sovereignty. And I appreciate that work. And hope that you continue to be blessed and given strength by the ancestors to continue. That's all I got to say.
Thank you. Thank you, brother.
And Brother Shakur, I'll be in touch with you because I have to come that way. My father and his people are from Richmond. But I was doing some family genealogy, so family research, and my great grandfather was born a slave, and he was born somewhere between 1850 and 1860, and he was born in Charlotte County because my grandfather said in his marriage certificate, he got married in 1915, and he mentioned his father's age, and that his father and mother were born in Charlotte County. But I can't find much information on them. And usually when you have a blank information dealing with our people, it's something that went on. Either somebody was lynched, some type of family tragedy happened. But I want to try to get maybe to the county seat. I don't know where the county seat of Charlotte is to try to research some of these records. And maybe
yeah,
you can...
Charlotte.
Go ahead.
It's ironic that you mentioned Charlotte County because Charlotte County was like, that area was known for lynching. That's one of the areas that John Mitchell Jr. First became on the stage of becoming an anti-lynch activist. It was a lynching that took place in Charlotte County. A guy named Richard something was lynched for something in Charlotte County. And John Mitchell Jr. went down there by himself. He had two Smith & Wessons on him and went down there in Charlotte County to protest the lynching because they had sent the Klan had sent him a letter from Charlotte County saying they're going to lynch him when they catch him. So he took it upon himself to go to Charlotte County to actually see if they was going to actually take part in trying to lynch him. And that's why he brought the two Smith & Wessons with him to defend himself and to, put up an organized front for the lynching that took place on the guy named Richie. So, yeah, Charlotte County is historical for lynching. It's ironic that you brought that up. And I'm hoping your ancestor didn't fall victim to that, but that would be a good idea to come down and find out.
Yeah, I'll be in touch with you because I might have to come that way. This has been on my heart for a while now to kind of, and I ran into a little brick wall when I found out where he was from, but couldn't get any information. So what I did, I ended up going to, it was three white families, plantation owners, that was in Charlotte County. And being that the name was Booker, I had to go to white Bookers to find out because, you know, our people took the surnames of these Europeans.
Exactly.
And so maybe you can help me with a little of that research. I'll be in touch with you. When I come that way, maybe we can hook up.
Yeah, most definitely.
Listen, before you leave, it's a caller jumped on. Let's see if they want to be part of the conversation. 816 area code. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
Hey, Brother Elliot. I was just Sam out of Kansas City. I just actually started listening to you, sir. And just really just listening right now, and then maybe I might come back in and comment, sir.
Okay, well, I'll put you back on hold.
Thank you, sir.
Brother Shakur, listen, I want to thank you for being with us, man, and looking forward to you joining us again.
I thank you. I appreciate it.
In conversation, and we'll be in touch, brother.
All right.
Peace. We'll be right back. We'll do a little open forum, Richard, and, you know, kind of share with the listening audience, see if anybody got some things they want to bring up. I know there's a lot of things on Brother Timothy's mind from South Philly there. I know he might want to jump back on the line. But if you got a few minutes, maybe we can spend a little time in open forum. What you think?
Got it. Okay. Let's do that.
Good, good. We'll be right back.
Tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
Antiquity to the present. Our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening. Sundays, 7 p.m. with your host, Reggie.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here. As many of you know, last March, when it was announced that I was no longer in the Black Muslim movement, it was pointed out that it was my intention to work among the 22 million non-Muslim Afro-Americans and to try and form some type of organization or create a situation where the young people, our young people, the students and others, could study the problems of our people for a period of time and then come up with a new analysis and give us some new ideas and some new suggestions as to how to approach a problem that too many other people had been playing around with for too long. And that we would have some kind of meeting and determine at a later date whether to form a Black Nationalist Party or a Black Nationalist Army. There have been many of our people across the country from all walks of life who have taken it upon themselves to try and pool their ideas and to come up with some kind of solution to the problem that confronts all of our people. And tonight we are here to try and get an understanding of what it is they've come up with.
The economic philosophy of black nationalism only means that we should own and operate and control the economy of our community. You would never find, you can't open up a black store in a white community. White man won't even patronize you. And he's not wrong. He got sense enough to look out for himself. And you who don't have sense enough to look out for yourself. The white man is too intelligent to let someone else come and gain control of the economy of his community. But you will let anybody come in and control the economy of your community. Control the housing, control the education, control the jobs, control the businesses, under the pretext that you want to integrate. No, you're out of your mind. The economic philosophy of black nationalism only means that we have to become involved in a program of re-education to educate our people into the importance of knowing that when you spend your dollar out of the community in which you live, the community in which you spend your money becomes richer and richer. The community out of which you take your money becomes poorer and poorer. And because these Negroes who have been misled, misguided, are breaking their necks to take their money and spend it with the man. The man is becoming richer and richer, and you're becoming poorer and poorer. And then what happens? The community in which you live becomes a slum. It becomes a ghetto. The conditions become run down. And then you have the audacity to complain about poor housing in a run-down community. Why, you run it down yourself when you take your dollar out.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening, and I want to thank our guest that was with us, spent a little over an hour and a half with us, activist, researcher, and historian, Aki Kweli Shakur, was with us to talk about the resistance of our ancestors and some of the sites that he organizes, as Brother Richard said, pilgrimage to in Virginia and North Carolina. You can reach out to him on Facebook and also his website if you're going that way, if you're in Virginia. Visiting relatives or in North Carolina, you can hook up with him and go on some of these pilgrimages to some of these sites. A lot of information there, and he has a lot of information. So I'm glad that he came on and shared tonight, Brother Richard, with the listening audience.
Sure, definitely.
You know, we're going to open forum, just banter around a few topics there with our listening audience. You know some of the things going on in Philadelphia. And before I touch on that, Richard, because I want you to, I know you want to speak on that. You're talking about the DA stuff, right?
Right.
Yeah, before you talk about that, I want to mention something. And it comes from a published report. I posted it on the radio station's Facebook page. And it's just a brief statement. The title of the article is Only Black People Showed Up to the D.C. Town Hall Meeting to Address the Surging Number of Missing Black Girls. And it showed some photographs of this town hall meeting. And the only white persons that I see in the photographs is those operating television cameras. It looked like hundreds of people in this town hall, and all of them were black. It says, earlier this year, the Women's March on Washington drew crowds that totaled close to 2 million attendees. Simultaneous marches were held in cities worldwide as women from all walks of life banded together to protest against various women's issues from equal pay to reproductive rights, which have long been central in the political debate. But where were these women when D.C.'s town hall meeting addressed last night the missing black girls? Where were they when this was taking place? Nowhere in sight. So, you know, we see again, because we talked about that before, we see when it's convenient and white women want to use black women to get out there and talk about the feminist issues or whatever, wearing pink hats and all that type of stuff. They'll use black women for that. But these issues that's coming up about these black girls in particular and black young people being missing have been going on for a while. Muhammad the Mortician came on our show a little over a year ago and talked about how a lot of these children are becoming missing. And then when they recovered, the body parts is missing. Organs is missing. Kendrick Johnson. It made the news when Kendrick Johnson, his parents said that he was missing down there. And I think it was in Atlanta, wasn't he?
Right.
Or it was in Georgia. They found him rolled up in the gym exercise mat. All his body parts, newspaper stuffed in the insides of his body, body parts missing. So, you know, if our children are becoming victim to human trafficking or organ trafficking, these things, you know, it's only hitting the news now because black social media sites are putting this information out. You don't see a lot of this stuff on the news. You don't see it. But as soon as Miss Ann or a young white-haired, blonde, white-haired, a white blonde-haired girl is missing, it's all over the news. Amber alerts and everything else. These are some of the things that some of these elected officials are to be dealing with and pushing it to the forefront. We need to start policing our own communities. If something don't look right, then we need, listen, Richard, and you know this is true. Anybody that sounded my voice know it's true. All you got to do is get out of your car, go to a predominantly white neighborhood, get out of your car and just start walking up and down the street and looking around like you're just looking at the buildings or maybe like you're lost. You won't get 5 minutes before the police pull up on you and ask you what you're doing here, can I help you, whatever. They got town watches in their communities. They're watching anything that don't look right. And you walking up and down their neighborhoods to them don't look right. We need to start town watches in our communities to stop this type of activity. And you see now that this news media are already trying to put a black face on it. I think in a couple of published reports, they didn't put black people up there saying that they're part of human trafficking here in the United States. Now, who believes that black people, they might be involved, some idiots might be involved in that. But who's going to believe that some black folks is instrumental in some international human trafficking ring or organ trafficking ring? But, you know,
it makes you wonder how vulnerable we are. You know, as you put out the call for us to do these town watches, and we talk about the police review boards and, you know, the community police review boards, and we talk of, you know, when you flip it on the other side, it just says, who's watching us?
Well, you supposed to have your black elected officials looking out for you. Listen, these white communities, when they want walkie-talkies for their town watch, reflective jackets, reflective baseball hats, whatever, they get their politicians, and they allocate money for them. Those things don't necessarily come out of their pocket. It's money allocated for them, and your tax dollars goes towards getting them new walkie-talkies, reflective coats, whatever, with their neighborhood or their township or their whatever on monogrammed on the coat. It's tax money that goes towards getting them that. So it's the same tax money that can be used if you had conscious black elected officials to start neighborhood town watches in their own community to watch over the neighborhood and watch these rogue police with the same walkie-talkies, reflective jackets, and things of that nature, and to get black people to start volunteering. I don't know whether some of these white people are getting paid to police their own communities, and they don't need to get paid. That clown that shot Trayvon Martin, he wasn't getting paid, but he put on his reflective jacket and he had his walkie-talkie and was in communication with police. These black elected officials, they need to
go through what you say, Elliot, about the question about, you know, us, you know, even when we talk about us taking our own ownership, though, of our community, I mean, of ourselves and therefore the place that we live. And therefore, the children that we should be responsible for. So that way we can be able to make sure that those, again, it, we have to put the right people in those political positions. You
yeah,
know,
but there's some of,
somebody's voting for these crazy people.
Yeah, I mean, and then they get in there like this clown here in Philadelphia, the district attorney. Right. He went in there under the premise that he wasn't, he was going to end stop and frisk and he was going to be just for black people. After he got in there, he wasn't interested in end stop and frisk. And all he wanted to do now, you see him under indictment, is line his pockets with special interest gifts and money.
And the things that, the thing, I mean, when I heard that he took money from his own mother, $20,000 from his own mother to pay for some place that he wanted to be in. It raised, it just, it, this, I don't know where, where he came from. I mean, to want to have a car, but the, as people are saying around here in Philadelphia, but then he had indicted these other black politicians who were set up.
Yeah, but they were set up, Richard, but they still took money.
Right.
Nobody forced that money in special gifts or in a Tiffany bracelet on Thomasine Tynes or forced money into Louise Williams' pocket after she's in there praising the Lord and then taking money. So ain't no, certainly they were set up, but nobody forced those gifts on them. And this guy, he what, a $30,000 couch? I can't even imagine you a $30,000 couch, a Jaguar XK6 or whatever, a $45,000 roof on his house, all types of lavish gifts and special trips. Come on here. These people are a disgrace, man. They're a disgrace.
At a point in time where people were concerned about health care and we're dealing with the question about the who's going to prison or not going to prison. And I don't know, you know, like the things that he's accused of, you would think he's like a playboy or something. You know, he want to pay for his ex-wife this and, you know, money for that, you know, get her a car, you know, forcing someone to get her a car.
So yeah, and then I think the girlfriend busted windows out of his car. Some old foolishness. I mean, what the hell? What are these people? What? Listen, we're in a situation, Richard, where our people are in danger in this country. I mean, even an organization like the Urban League, which is not a grassroots organization at all, it's a bourgeois organization founded by white folks. Even they say in their report on Black America that black people in every strata of life is under attack. So if you're a black elected official, you go in, you're supposed to go in with a mindset of defending your people from attack. Not assimilating, not ready to surrender. These guys, I mean, they don't even go in here with a mindset to fight for their people. It's no fighting. It's giving up, bending over, and all that type of stuff. Come on here. All right, come on. Let's take a couple.
They think it's a what's that called? A money chest, and they're just supposed to open it and dig their hand in and walk that way whatever they can carry.
Yeah, they're gonna dig their hand in, all right. They might not like what they pull out. Let's go to 646 area code. What's your name? Where you calling from?
Hey, what's going on, Brother Elliot? This is Brother Jay.
Hey Jay, how you doing, man?
I'm good, man. Hey, listen, your DA down there near you, man, that must be a hell of a savage there, boy, or he just dubbed stupid. I can't figure homeboy out because if he thought he was going to get away with the stuff they got him on, something's basically wrong with him. I mean, stealing from his mother, not paying her bill, I mean, taking couches and all this other stuff. What's wrong with him? I mean, didn't he see what they did to Chucka for Todd and his son? So what makes him think that he was so much special?
Well, you know, a lot of them people, when they ascend to those positions, Jay, as you well know, they don't really think that they're black anymore. They think that they're somehow different. You remember O.J., he used to say, well, I'm not black, I'm O.J. I think they think that they're somehow different than you or me.
Well, hey, listen, I tell you this. I hope you know, things work out for him. I hope that he's smart enough to plead guilty and do his time in one of those country club fed jails, because he's going to jail for maybe 3 to 5 if he can work out a good deal. Because there's no way in hell they're going to
walk. I think it's going to be more than some 3 to 5. You being lenient.
I just said to you, if he worked out a deal with him, you know, because it makes no sense to fight when you know you got him. That's the problem with your boy Chaka Fatah and his son. Now, Chaka should have known he was dead and wrong. But, you know, he just basically wanted to play the game, and now he goes and die in prison, unfortunately. But, you know, he was of no great value anyway, if the truth be told.
But you know, brother, it's something else, or at least I bring to the perspective something else that's going on here, because it seems that the FBI has been targeting black politicians, and it's not just black, but in this round, a series of black politicians, they are like on them, like they're, you know, everything they do, they've been watching and they've been pouncing. And I'll just use the example in Philadelphia with the mayor, Mayor Street. If it wasn't for the police chief's son who worked for the FBI to inform him that the FBI was wiretapping the office, and it just so happened he's the only one that didn't get caught up. As you say, Ellie, he's the only one that didn't take anything. Where the others, they did get caught up, and they did get prison time. But then it's on the other side with these black politicians, or the culture of the party, because the party's been stealing money. So when you get in there, you think you're supposed to be able to do that too.
No, you got too much melanin in your skin, so cut it out. But let me ask you this right quick. Did the FBI godson go to jail for tipping him off?
Nope.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Thank goodness he had the intelligence to back away and do the right thing. You know, because most Negroes, they don't heed a warning. You know, because they think they special once they get in that position. But, you know, I'm glad to hear that he was smart enough to fall back. But, you know, the real thing I was calling about, Elliot, was this fiasco and game that is being played on white folks and this so-called members of the Democratic Party. Now, as you could see, this Trump care, Ryan care, Obama care, whatever care you want to call this care, health care, zoo care, you know, dog and pony care, whatever, didn't pass, you know, Thursday. They pulled it out. But the thing is this. The things that were in play within that whole health care reform were so dastardly and so wicked and evil by this character Ryan that it just goes to show, number one, what type of animal he is. Number two, how they just don't think that the American people are anything in regards to having any form of intelligence. And that basically they could be played in as stupid as they really are. Which, you know something? I've been thinking about this. I really, really think what happened, Elliot, and Richard, it was a bait and switch game to do what they really want to do this week with tax reform. I think the American public been played. I really think they knew that there was nothing that they could really do in regards to that whole health care, because number one, the way that it was set up, the way that it would affect so many people. But the tragedy is, with all of that said and done, after 7 years, think of it this way. The Republicans had no plan in place to repeal and replace, which is frightening if you think about it, because there it is, you spent 7 years of people's lives promising them that you was going to be able to do something. Number two, which is even more wicked and evil, is the Democratic Party has nothing in place to fix their signature program. That's what's so evil and wicked is, that they jumping up and all of that, talking about all the American people had a victory and this and that. But in reality, the American people are still getting screwed. You know, and the thing is, the American people who are so blatantly dumb and naive, they think that they won something. But now the real sinisterness is going to come into play with the tax reform. Oh, it's no telling what they're going to do with tax reform. You know, I really truly believe, and I left this out, that they're still going to destroy the medical care system anyway, because now what's going to happen is whoever the head of health in this country is just going to absolutely pick and choose, cut and tear, and do everything he got to do to Medicaid and Medicare to just make it of really no value. So they're basically going to get their wish. But I really want to see what's going to happen with this whole tax reform. Because think about it. What they were trying to do for the rich people in the medical, what the hell do you think they're going to do now that we're dealing strictly with taxes? I mean, what are they going to make it to? Whereas if you make over $1 million a year, you're not going to have to pay absolutely no taxes. But if you make under, let's say, $35,000 or lower, you're going to have to pay, what, 40, 50% in taxes? And then on top of that, if you make over $100,000, you're going to maybe have to pay 30, 40% in taxes? I mean, this is about to be so crazy and wicked, and American people don't even have a clue what's about to happen. And then the thing is, people like you, Brother Elliot, with small businesses and things of that nature, they're going to do their thing on y'all too. They're going to not do anything that's going to benefit you. So where it is now, it's just going to be madness. And you know they're not going to take another loss. And you know the Democrats are not going to be able to define it. Because listen, this is one of those things to where, as if they have to, they'll filibuster and they'll do whatever they have to do to make sure that it's passed, because it's really about money now. It's really about rewarding those who back Trump, who's basically any and every day that he's in office shows how much of a blatant, naive, foolish idiot that he is, who don't read, who don't know nothing about policy, who's just basically being led like a dog on a leash. But Americans still think that sucker's intelligent, smart, and he's going to make America great again.
Jay.
I love it. When is America ever going to be great again?
Jay, thank you for your contribution, man, as always.
All right, my brother. Have a good one.
Peace. Let's go to 773.
Talking to me, brother?
Yes, sir.
Don't call me sir, brother. I work for a living.
Brother X.
Yes, sir. Sometimes it pains me greatly to call shows like this.
Why does it pain you, Brother X?
Because I know you all believe that you can do something in this white supremacy country and change it, but I have to give you a reality check, like the brother, the African brother that called Jay and Marcus Garvey said. The great Marcus Garvey said, if we do not go back, now he's saying this in the 20s, people. Garvey said, if we do not go back and reclaim Africa for us and the Africans, he said they was going to do away with us here, and then they were going to do away with the Africans. And it is going exactly as Garvey said it would. Garvey said independence and self-determination is based on land. Land is not a lot or a plot. Land is at least a state, country, a continent. The white supremacy country, what we call America, is not going to let us to have land that they have conquered. Now, we can either get out or die. Now, it is critical, Brother Elliot, that we pay attention to this white supremacy power structure as to what they want and how they are going about it. Now, there's the articles in the papers I'm seeing all the time. Bannon, Donald Hitler, top man, is talking about the deep state troubles the White House, that there's a power structure in the country stopping them from doing what they want to do. But this is the same power structure that put them all in office.
Mm-hmm.
Now they are complaining about the power structure stopping him from doing what he want to do. And he's doing just about everything he want to do. Now, why is he saying this stuff? They are telling the psychopaths they still got to take this country back. Somebody is stopping them. Now, this is what people must watch. The people that control this country and the world, who put Donald Hitler in, put in Barack O. Bush, or George O. Bush, the people who put all these psychopaths in, they controlled Donald Hitler too. Why is they letting them say this crazy stuff? Why is they letting this crazy rhetoric go on about they still got to take their country back from this shadow government? Why is the power structure letting this go on? Because they have to create an atmosphere in this country of chaos, and white people are losing it for them to do what they have planned. And what they have planned is to exterminate us. Now, I want to tell people again, you don't have to listen to me, but I want to put it on the table. If you can get out of here, get some grandchild out, some child, if you are able, get them out. Our time is up. They have worked us for 400 years. They have stolen all our ventures. They lynch us. They're killing us right now in the streets as I speak. How do you think that is going to change? That is hey, man, I hate to call it, but that's buffoonery. There's no way that is going to change. So if you can change, if you can get out of here, I suggest if you get out. Now, I can't tell you where to go. I'm going to tell you that again. The only place I've been is Vietnam. I can't tell you where to go. But I'm going to tell you what Willie said many moons ago down on the plantation when they was in the shack. All the slaves was in the shack one night, and Willie started packing his pillowcase. And the other slaves, they were looking at each other. Man, they looked at Willie, and one of them said, "What you doing, Willie?" Willie said, "I's leaving. I's getting out of here." He said, "Well, where you going, Willie?" Willie said, "I don't know. But that's the one thing I do know. Anywhere is going to be better than him." This is where we find ourselves. These people are finished with us. They are going to exterminate us. Now, I can be wrong.
Relax.
I got 16 grandchildren. I can't save them. I hope I'm wrong. I hope somebody said, "Brother X, you was wrong." Man, I'll jump up and click my heel. I hope I'm wrong, but I don't see I'm being wrong.
Well, once you get where you're going, I want you to give us a call because me and Richard might join you.
Brother, I hope I can make it. But, you know, they killed Malcolm X's grandson down in Mexico.
Well, you don't want to go to Mexico, do you? And you definitely don't want to go to Vietnam. You said Vietnam. You want to go back there?
Hey, but right now, you got to get out of the cooker. See, when you got when you in a fire and a hot skillet is next to the fire, if you can jump in the hot skillet out of the fire, you jump in the hot skillet. You'll recall in the World Trade Center when this white boy blew them up. You saw people jumping off the Nanias float. If you had told them people before that, they'll jump off the Nanny Flow, them people would have told you you was crazy. But goddamn, they jumped off the Nanny Flow. And that's where we at.
Relax.
The Nanny Flow and the building's on fire. Now what you gonna do?
Relax. Thank you for your call, man.
Thank you for being there, brother. Thank you for letting me talk, brother. I appreciate it.
Peace.
Straight ahead.
Let's go to 267. 267. 267.
What's happening, L? What's happening?
Brother Tim?
Yes, how are you, sir?
Yeah, I know you want to talk about your DA, your favorite DA.
Man, you and Richard know what it's like in Philadelphia, man. You know, I hope whoever's listening could hear about. You would think we're in Chicago. They would probably call Chicago the Windy City because you know the direction it was going to go in. It was the politics they were talking about. Now, this is not the cold. But, I mean, all those after one another indictments, man. I mean, I'm saying like Richard is saying, there's something better than that. We got to change the culture of that. I mean, we're going to have people in the future who are going to want to run for office and do some good things, man. And this would be an example to them that you get in office, man, you serve the people. You know, you don't get in the office thinking you're going to become.
Yeah, but they don't serve their people, Tim.
Right.
They don't serve their.
Right.
They give excuses for not serving their people. Oh, I've been elected by everybody.
Exactly right. You go in, they want to bust up unions. They want to close schools. They want to gentrify the community and bring in developers. You're like, all these people.
But they doing what they told.
But see, you know, Elliot, you listen, man. This guy made $175,000 a year. He got $15,000 a month. People don't know this. He's also a military person. He got a check a month. He's also in the military for a certain amount of years. While in the reserves, he gets a check from the military. He got a city car. And they gave him a car to put gas in it. And he got a person to drive it. He don't even need a car. And a gas car. And he has mailing privileges. He's complaining about the tuition of his two children in private school. You're making $15,000 a year. You're complaining about a little tuition for two girls.
Well, then, and Richard, and maybe you can jump in.
The other thing is, like you said, a $35,000. I'd like to know what that $35,000 account looks like. A Jaguar, right? Trips to Punta Cana, problems with his girlfriend. Somebody asked me if he's sniffing coke. I mean, come on, man. I mean, what are you? And then you're gonna turn around and you'll say this is about law and order. This ain't about color. Then you said that you sat down at the table with Louise Bishop Williams and dinner with her family, and you want to jail her. You jailed Thomasina Times. You came after hell, the same thing you did. You want to jail her. I mean, what kind of man is it? And guess what, my friend? Like Jay said, he don't want to go to trial. He's saying he wants his day in court. And his attorney said he's innocent. Okay. I just read the 50-page, 23 counts of charges. He got people that's going to testify against him. Now, if you don't think that's crazy, you're going to... And they might even tell them what to say. You got somebody testified against you, and they're already against you now. Okay, that's the way. You get everything, like you said, Elliot. Why did you even do it? You begged for the seat. You said Linda Hay was supposed to, she was supposed to make you the heir apparent. The community listened to you, and the people that he made them resign helped them to get in office.
Richard, listen, let me ask you a question, Richard.
Yes.
What makes, and you weigh in on this too, Tim.
Right.
What do you think is wrong when these people are doing this, or our people are doing this? Do you think it's something inherently wrong with black folks that they get in office and start taking money?
No, can I give you an example? Before Richard talks, I'll let Richard talk. I'll tell you what my experience would have been if I would have won the state rep seat. It was easier for me to run the state rep seat as opposed to the Congress seat.
that year that I ran in 2012, if I had been made to have been blessed to have that seat, my idea was the office that I rented, that was going to be my office on 21st and Warden, number one. The people who helped me, I helped them. That the money that I got from the state for rent would have been going to that person who helped me, the Booker family. That's one, number one. Okay. Number two, the street workers who helped me, I would have got them jobs. Those are the ones who are working for me. Those are the community. I mean, my thing ain't to hook up with somebody who was a part of the Democratic Party, who was looking to hook up with another man, and once I get there, I hook up with the Democratic Party, who wasn't trying to help me. That's not correct thinking. Then you have to look at what's the problems in the city. Education, economics, crime. And you have to be, and matter of fact, the place where I rented my campaign office, I met there Sundays, not every Sunday. Those people were my people. And they had a radio program, which you have now today. Those are the people that I was connected to before I became that. See, these people want to get in office, and what was their connection before they got in office? What were they like before they got in office? See, a lot of times you want to hurry up and get this person in, get that person in. So somebody's telling you, but do you know them? Dude, I don't vote for somebody I don't know something about them. This is not a celebrity contest. They go around and look good and wear a suit and drive a car. They take a bunch of girls out. I ain't trying to do that.
Well, Richard, what do you think?
We have to say also, looking at the DA race, the historical reality is that the DA's race is a low turnout anyway, right?
Yes,
I mean,
it is.
Population voting-wise. So we ain't talking about, even if it's celebrity, status, we ain't talking about an influence that is affecting a large part of the population, and particularly with black candidates, a large part of the black candidates on that election itself, right? That's one. And two, the other thing is that we, and correct me if I'm wrong, the party infrastructure assists in getting the candidate. And now, when I say party infrastructure, I'm talking about in this city, it's the ward leaders and whatever. And they, in some cases, don't even want to move unless they get a bag. Now, where the money come from for the bag, is up for the air. And that ain't technically supposed to happen like that. But what they call street money is the way the game works. And that number of people who are going out on the streets is small, but they want that little bit of cash, or they want that cash, right? So you're already in a process where it's unethical, right? And then when we're talking about once you're dealing with that, the party, as you said, the party mechanism says, well, we got patronage, or we can get certain of your people a job. It goes up and might say, we can get certain of your people a contract. Right?
Right.
That ain't all your people. That's just a certain number of people.
Exactly.
And they work and they support. Well, that might be where you, as you call the celebrity status, but it's still not the community. But for those people, that they have an influence, so you got a little smaller turnout. You got a organized infrastructure. You got little money come to them, and I've seen one recent with the presidential election, the war leader was saying he had no money, so if he didn't know, nobody was going to go out. Or he took money, or he or she took money out of his own pocket to pay.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So so the system itself, the culture of the party process doesn't support working for the constituency that lives in the territory. Now, the constituency ain't organized.
But see, that's why you got to go in with a whole different mindset if you're talking about a black politician. Because, Richard and Tim, listen here.
Okay.
This guy is no different than any other black politician. Now, it's either something wrong with black politicians where they're getting these offices to take money, or money is always exchanged. Now, just crisscross the country, for example. You down south, you had Ray Nagin. In Detroit, you had Kwame Kilpatrick, Jesse Jackson Jr.'s son, him and his wife, Shaka Fatah. Just a little small snippet around the country. Mm-hmm. All these black politicians with corruption taking money. Now, it's either something wrong with the black politicians, or are they doing something that nobody else is doing? Now, look at this guy here as an example. He worked under Lynn Abraham, the racist DA that was in there before him, that said that the reason black people, she arrests black people because black people do all the crimes. Now, he worked in her office. Now, the way politics is in the United States, not just Philadelphia, United States political system, is money. Quid pro quo, you do for me, I do for you. So I'm quite sure that he was aware of the people that Lynn Abraham dealt with. And I'll use her as an example. Because people with money pay both sides of the aisle. They pay Democrats and Republican candidates depending on who wins or who's going to win. So if he knew the people that was dealing with Lynn Abraham, for example, when he wins the office, those same people, Richard and Tim, will come to him to deal with him. Now, if he decides to deal with them, he don't see nothing wrong with it because Lynn Abraham did it. The only thing is, when he does it, then he gets nailed. That's why I'm saying these politicians get in office, they don't see themselves as black anymore until something happens. Then they realize they're black. Because I don't think he's did anything any different than his predecessors. It's just he got nailed. You don't think, come on here, I ain't stupid. I know that Lynn Abraham took gifts. She took trips. She took probably the same thing he did, maybe more, because she was in office longer. But he got nailed, along with some of these other ones. That stuff that Shaka Fatah was doing probably wasn't no different than any other politician, white politician. But those guys get nailed. They don't think they're black anymore until they get nailed.
Okay. So, Elliot, are you there? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Elliot, Richard? Okay. So, you're exactly right. So, Elliot, at that point, let me give you an example of what you're saying is correct. Farnese was in an investigation just like the same time Shaka was. Farnese got right out of it. You'll hear about no more. He's still saying senator. You're exactly right. Nobody said anything. People don't remember that. But you have to know that you black. I'm always going to be suspicious. I look at what happened to this person and that person. I would be, well, I ain't dealing with you. And if you're doing what you're supposed to do with the community, it's the vote that gets you in.
I think it's not. We have to be maybe. I'm gonna be arrogant. You have to be honest. It ain't about vote. It ain't even about money. It's about power.
Yeah.
And let's use the example of Rizzo. Rizzo came in where he said, "I got a book on everybody else."
Exactly.
In my book, I got a name. Now, do you think that held other people up for coming at him any other kind of way when they didn't want to come at him? Any of them black politicians. And ask look at Lynn Abraham and ask the question, what leverage does she have outside of the position that she holds? You don't think she holds some leverage, therefore, i.e. power? But look at any one of those black politicians. Okay, what leverage do they have?
Okay, wait a minute. Not only did Lynn Abraham have leverage, but it's something about the psychology of the black woman and male. I'm going to give you an example about Rizzo people. I knew people that didn't like Rizzo, but they had in their mind, if I have Rizzo in there, he's going to straighten out the streets, which is bullshit. See, Rizzo looked out for his people, and he was a racist. But in these people's mind, even when the problems with drugs were out, people said to me, if I wish I could re-erect Rizzo, because we wouldn't have
that's what they're saying about Kenny.
That's what they're saying about Kenny. Kenny. I mean, they're saying the same thing about Kenny. But that doesn't address, that's the voting level. But we're talking about, well, I'm trying to suggest that at the level of power, which means that you have influence over somebody to do something that they wouldn't want to do anyway, that doesn't it doesn't matter about the vote. It matters what is it that you have that you can be able to say, look, you do this to me, this is what's going to happen to you.
I go with that. I can go with that, too. Some people have a fear. Tim, some people have a hidden fear about certain people. Okay.
Thank you for your call. Thank you for your call, man.
All right.
Peace.
Peace.
Richard, we're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we'll kind of wind things down. But if somebody wanted to get in, they can in the last few minutes by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We've been open for them the rest of the way, so give us a call the last few minutes. We'll be right back.
Tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services if when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
Hey, did y'all see the stuff I posted on my wall?
Nah, it didn't even show up in my news feed.
Man, I'm done with social media. All the injustice and brutality going around, and it's like they're trying to suppress our voice. We're trying to get the message out there, and you can't even share empowerment and what's going on around the country either.
Mm-mm. Nah, don't be dumb with social media, though. It's a tool, and there is a place where we have a voice. It's a Let's Buy Black 365 social network. You do anything you want on any other social network. Post pictures, videos, status updates, share resources and community news. But on Let's Buy Black 365, it's a platform for us and by us to tell our messages.
Whoa, that's like a digital underground railroad.
What's the name of that site again?
It's letsbuyblack365.com.
Yeah, I heard about that. It's all about networking, and you get points, right?
Yeah, the more you network, post, and share, the more points you get. Plus, you get points for posting pictures, sharing information, attending community events, and inviting others to network with you on the app.
Wow, that's all I need to know. I'm gonna go download that app right now.
Now, better yet, let me invite you so I can get some points. It's all about empowerment and solutions, y'all.
Yeah, that's what's up. I'm all in.
Let's do it. Let's share our stories.
Let's buy Black365.com.
What is in 1 million brothers and sisters who are tired of the same old rhetoric, the same old leaders, the same old ways of dealing with political and economic empowerment? you realize that nobody's going to save black people but us, if you understand that no existing political party prioritizes the best interests of African Americans as a collective, if you believe that leadership is as leadership does, and this means that the best leaders for the black collective must come from the ranks of those who place and hold the best interests of black people foremost and uttermost, if you understand that black people must develop the mindset and the will to finance their own racial uplift organizational efforts, then get involved with 1 million conscious black voters and contributors. The movement is now. Go to www.iamoneofthemillion.com. That's www.iamoneofthemillion.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
When I am dead, wrap the mantle of the red, the black, and the green around me, for in the new life I shall rise up with God's grace and blessing to lead the millions of the heights and the triumph that you well know. Look for me in a whirlwind or a storm. Look for me all around you. For with God's grace, I shall come back with countless millions of black men and women who have died in America, those who have died in the West Indies, and those who have died in Africa to aid you in the fight for liberty, freedom, and life. Any leadership that teaches you to depend upon another race is a leadership that will enslave you. Any leadership that teaches you to depend upon another race is a leadership that will enslave. They gave leadership to our foreparents, and that leadership made them slaves. But we have decided to find a leadership of our own to make ourselves free men. Our great scholars have inspired through the colleges, the universities, have thrown away the blessed record. Babylon did it. Assyria did it. France under Napoleon did it. Germany under Prince von Bismarck did it. England under America under George Washington did it. Africa with 400 million black people can do it. If you cannot do it, if you are not prepared to do it, then you will die. You race of cowards, you race of imbeciles, you race of good for nothing. If you cannot do what other men have done, what other nations have done, what other races have done, then you have better die. Can we do it? Yes. We can do it.
Yes. We will.
We shall do it.
Yes.
We have prayed to God for vision and for leadership.
Yes.
And He has given us our universal vision. A vision that will not limit our possibilities to America. A vision that will not limit our possibilities to the West Indies. But a vision that said it must be a free and redeemed Africa.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening, and the guest that was on for the first portion of the program, activist and researcher and historian, Brother Haki Kweli Shakur, joined us this evening, and it was an interesting conversation, Brother Richard, with
yes,
our guest. And, you know, I want to read from this article, too, Richard, for our listening audience, because it kind of, it troubled me when I read it. But I can't say I'm surprised. You're familiar with Henrietta Lacks, right, Richard?
Right.
For our listening audience who don't know, she died in 1951 of cervical cancer, but her cells were harvested from her body without her permission, definitely, and without her family's permission. And Johns Hopkins, along with pharmaceutical companies, years later, have made probably untold billions on her immortal cells. Well, it was an article in Black Star News. No, I'm sorry, the Atlanta Black Star, in reference to the new television movie that Oprah Winfrey is making about Henrietta Lacks. And did you run across that article, Richard?
No, not the article, but I know about Oprah making a movie.
Let me read to you what is stated in the Atlanta Black Star, and for our listening audience that's not familiar. Henrietta Lacks' son and grandson say Oprah is only the latest to exploit the family for her own gain. March 22nd article. The family of Henrietta Lacks has issued a startling new claim about Oprah Winfrey, who is starring in and producing the HBO film adaptation of a book based on Henrietta Lacks's life. Lawrence Lacks, the 82-year-old son of Henrietta Lacks and present executor of her estate, alleges Winfrey's HBO film, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, presents inaccuracies about his mother, stemming from the 2010 book by the same name by Rebecca Skloot. It's bad enough John Hopkins took advantage of us, Lawrence Lacks said in a statement provided to the Atlanta Black Star. Now Oprah, Rebecca Skloot, and HBO are doing the same thing. They're no better than the people they say they hate. Lawrence Lacks told the Baltimore Sun in February that agreements between John Hopkins Hospital and the National Institute of Health to use his mother's cells for research are invalid. Such agreements did not include compensation, and Lawrence Lacks said the organization has been profiting off the cells known as HeLa cells without a penny going to the family. Henrietta Lacks' cervical cells were used to create the first immortal human cell in 1951 without her permission. On the inaccuracies portrayed in the film and the book, Henrietta Lacks' grandson, Ron Lacks, who is gearing up to take over the executive duties from his father, Lawrence Lacks, met with Oprah at a luncheon to discuss the movie's development, where she and the film's director, George Wolfe, promised to portray Henrietta Lacks' story accurately. We expressed to Oprah that we didn't like the book, Ron Lacks says, and Oprah stated, well, I ain't going by the book. I'm going to do my own thing. I mean, that's a little conversation with me and my father. I don't know what to say about her, but she didn't try to do what she said she was going to do. Ron Lacks debunked several factual errors in the book and the HBO film that his father outlined in a press release, clarifying that Henrietta Lacks was a sharecropper who owned land and was not an enslaved woman, that she could actually read and write, and proved it by documents showing her name written in cursive, that all of Lacks' children did not attend Henrietta Lacks' funeral, which Skloot stopped Lawrence Lacks from revealing in his book, and that the family was actually educated rather than impoverished and uneducated. It's a part of Skloot's racist mythology, Lawrence Lacks says. If she can present the family as poor and uneducated, then she can herself, as a spokesperson for the family, make money and promote herself on her lies. It makes a better story if we are poor and dumb. I would like to give her the benefit of the doubt, said Ron Lacks. Let me skip down to some of this. Not only are they making money using my mother's name, they're telling people that they're supporting us and they're not. Lawrence Lacks said in a statement, it's embarrassing. Ron Lacks says the filmmaker offered him and his father $16,600 to consult on the film, which they turned down. That's an insult to me and my father, says Ron Lacks, adding the movie spent more than $35,000 on catering. Ron Lacks also confirmed that the money Skloot promised the family through her 2010 establishment of Henrietta Lacks Foundation largely did not receive any money except for family members who signed their rights away. and his cousin and his uncle, who had gone on a press tour with Skloot. So, we see from his family, Richard, Henrietta Lacks' family, her brother, who is the executor of her estate, and her grandson, which is the son of her brother, that's about ready to take over as executor, I guess maybe because his father's getting up there in age, said that they met with Oprah. And they told Oprah about the book and how the woman took advantage of them and printed inaccuracies about their mother. Oprah promised them that they wouldn't do that and said that she's doing the same thing. Offered them $16,600. And they said it was an insult. They said it's not about money, but it's about fairness if they wanted to use their mother's story. Offered them $16,000 between two men. And they turned it down, said it was an insult, and they spent $35,000 on catering. Oprah's a billionaire. See, some of our people, they got to stop doing this type of stuff to others of us. You can't do that. And then, some of these people that are making money, Oprah and others, wonder why people call them all kind of names. You're taking advantage of these people. They've been already taken advantage by this government and by these pharmaceutical companies, harvesting their mother's cells and making untold billions, and the family is without any compensation. But then you're going to come along, the white woman that made that book in 2010 made money, promised the family money. None of them got anything except for two family members that went on tour with her. Wow. Well, I thought that share that with the listening audience. They can go to the Atlanta Black Star and see the whole article in its entirety, or go to the Time for Awakening Facebook page because I posted it up there. But Richard, we're coming down to the conclusion of another program. The program out of Los Angeles, California, the young lady, Sister Zion, with the Shifting Paradigm, she started her program on Saturday evening, and she'll be doing it on Thursday at 9 to 11, and Saturdays from 9 to 11. So it's other programs on Time for Awakening Network that's being introduced. She started her program this Saturday. She'll be airing again on Thursday at 9 to 11. Revive with Sister POC is on Wednesdays from 8 to 10, also Sundays from 11 to 1, dealing specifically with young black millennials. She's a young black woman herself, along with a couple of her co-hosts, all young women. So things are growing, Richard. So we just do what we do, and things going to keep on happening. That's all I can say.
Yes, it will. And good things are that.
I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion, as always. And we'll be back on Friday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.